Welcome, and thank you for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. At that time, you may press star one to ask a question. I would like to now turn the call over to John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. Good morning, and welcome to this media teleconference to discuss NOAA and NASA's data for the 2021 global temperature record and other climate highlights from the year. I'm John Bateman, a public affairs officer with NOAA's Office of Communications, and I will be facilitating the call today. NOAA and NASA are two keepers of the world's temperature data and independently produce a record of changes to Earth's surface temperatures based on historical observations over the ocean and land. Consistency between these two independent analyses and those analyses produced by science agencies and other countries increases our confidence in the accuracy and assessment of the data, as well as the resulting conclusions. Today's 2021 Global Climate Review will feature a short presentation followed by a media question and answer session. This teleconference is also being streamed live by NASA at nasa.gov/NASA Live. I will also spell that for you. It is www.nasa.gov/NASALIVE. Our first presenter is Russell Bose, Chief of the Analysis and Synthesis Branch at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of NOAA's 2021 global temperature and climate data. Our second presenter is Gavin Schmidt, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, who will summarize NASA's average global temperature and climate data for 2021. We will kick off this teleconference with Russ from NOAA.
Hey, good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us. Just a quick reminder before we get started that both NOAA and NASA use surface data in measuring global temperature. Over the oceans, we use sea surface temperatures from ships and buoys, and over the land, we use air temperatures from surface weather stations. So this makes us a little different from some of the other groups out there, like the Copernicus Climate Change Service, who uses a weather forecast model, so to speak. So we're starting with slide number two, and this figure shows basically the evolution of temperature, annual temperature, through time since the late 19th century. The punchline here is that in the NOAA analysis, 2021 ranked sixth warmest on record, was 8.84 degrees C above the 20th century baseline, which is just slightly warmer than 2018. Having said that, I think the more important point on this map is the last 7 years, i.e. the last seven dots on the right side of the plot, which really stand above the rest of the record. Looking a bit further back, meaning at the blue bars, it's clear that each of the past four decades has been warmer than the one that preceded it, and there's been a steady increase in temperature since at least the 1960s. Looking further back to the late 19th century, there's obviously been warming for a long time now, and not shown in the plot, it's certainly warmer now than at any time in at least the past 2,000 years, and probably much longer. As for what's coming up next year, while barring something like a major volcanic eruption or a comet slamming into the planet, I'm channeling Don't Look Up here, there's probably a 99% chance that 2022 will rank in the top 10, a 50-50 chance, maybe a little less, that it'll rank in the top 5, and a 10% chance that it'll rank first. And of course, all this is driven by increasing concentrations of heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide, which set a record in 2021 at 419 parts per million at Mauna Loa in May. Now I'll turn it over to Gavin for the NASA analysis for this year.
Thank you very much, Russ. So you'll notice that on slide three, the main difference is the color scheme. And there are detailed differences in how we process this information. Excuse me. But you'll see that the same grouping of the last 7 years, all of which are more than 1 degree Celsius above the 19th century, late 19th century, the baseline that we sometimes use. NASA's ranking was also sixth warmest, basically a statistical tie with 2018. But all of these things are within the within the uncertainty of the annual means. The uncertainty is around 0.06 degrees Celsius on any one of the annual numbers. Russ?
All right, thanks, Gavin. Now we're on to slide number 4. This figure shows basically, it's a map of the world, and it shows you where temperatures were above the long-term average or below the long-term average for the year. So the punchline here, the main punchline, is it was warm over most land areas in 2021. By warm, those are areas that are colored in red. But it wasn't crazy warm in any one place, maybe a degree or two Celsius above the baseline in most areas, and maybe a bit more in a few areas such as eastern Canada. But remember that certainly more extreme patterns are possible. Some of you who tuned in last year might recall that 2020 was a real scorcher in Siberia, so there were lots of bright reds in the map. This year didn't feature those patterns so much on the annual basis. So in 2020, over the land surface, there were only a few isolated pockets of below-average conditions, meaning bluish boxes, and those were mainly in parts of Alaska, Canada, Northern Asia, Southern Africa, and Central Australia. Over the oceans, most areas were above the long-term baseline. Again, they were in reddish colors, with the obvious exception of the tropical eastern Pacific, which was below normal, meaning blue. This pattern is known as La Nina. It first developed in mid 2020, and it continued through most of 2021. I think there might have been a month or two that technically wasn't La Nina. La Nina is the opposite of El Nino. In El Nino, you have warm temperatures in the eastern Pacific. La Nina tends to cool temperatures, global temperatures slightly, because it's a big chunk of the Earth's surface. El Nino tends to boost global temperatures a bit. The effect of La Nina tends to lag temperatures by 3 to 6 months, so the slight cooling effect may persist a bit into 2022. Now back to Gavin.
Thanks, Russ. So if you go to slide 5, you see the equivalent map from the NASA analysis. You'll notice a couple of differences. One is in the Arctic and polar areas, where the GIS analysis uses the fact that temperature anomalies have a quite large footprint to interpolate across the Arctic, and so that makes a difference to how we calculate the global mean. But the patterns you'll see are very similar, and unsurprisingly, really. Over to you, Russ.
All right, thanks, Gavin. So on to the next slide. It's titled NOAA Significant Events for 2021. And the punchline here is there are no shortage of extremes. I'm not going to go through everything on this, and actually I have a few others to toss in, but the story here is this slide does not even begin to show all the extremes that took place in 2021. I saw a statistic in the Washington Post a couple of days ago saying that like 40% of all people in the United States live in a county that was hit by a climate disaster this year based on federal disaster declarations. So there's been a lot going on. And here are just a few examples from the U.S. and the world. In January, you saw the worst Spanish snowstorms in a half a century. In February, there was the major freeze event in Texas and Oklahoma and adjacent areas, which I think totaled $23 billion in damages and hundreds of deaths. We also saw the worst locust plagues in decades in East Africa. March, there were major floods in eastern Australia and the worst sandstorm in Beijing in a decade. April, there were hailstones and other severe weather in Texas and Oklahoma. May, there were tornadoes and flooding in Louisiana, and you get the idea. I can go on and on. In June, there was the Dixie Fire in California, which is a huge event, obviously, and the fires in general, I think, totaled up to over $10 billion in damages in the United States, and, of course, the heat waves, and I can go on and on and on. On the bright side, and I know this is a funny thing to say, but there were only 37 hurricane-strength storms worldwide this year. That's actually the lowest in the 41-year record. For the U.S. in particular, there were 20 weather and climate disasters that had losses exceeding $1 billion each, and the total damages for 2021 were something like $145 billion, which is the third highest on record. Not that that's the most important statistic. There were at least 688 folks who lost their lives due to these disasters, which is also the highest in a decade. So what's the bottom line here? Well, unfortunately, we certainly expect to see more of these types of extremes in the warming world. And some of the events this year were probably not even possible without global warming, or at least they were made much worse by it. For example, the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest or the floods in Germany. But there are other individual events, such as the freeze in Texas or some of the tornado outbreaks, that still have particular circumstances that need to be sorted out. Was there a climate change component? And that's on the frontier of science right now. Back to Gavin.
Thanks, Russ. Moving to slide 7. One of the things that we like to do is try and see to what extent the trends may be becoming clearer if we try and subtract out the impacts of El Nino, Southern Oscillation variability in the Eastern Pacific, and so that's the graph here that you see. And so we started 2021 with a mild La Nina event, which was noticeably different from 2020, but is actually quite similar to what 2022 will be. By kind of, you know, regressing out the signal that we expect from a particular La Nina or El Nino, we can get the red line there, which is an ENSO-corrected estimate of the temperatures. And you can see that it has a little bit less variability than the raw data. But it's still, there's still ups and downs. And those ups and downs are related to, you know, other modes of internal variability. There's some volcanoes that are marked on there. Obviously, they make a very clear cooling in the signal. But if you look at just like the last few years, you'll notice that even in the ENSO-corrected data, 2021 was noticeably cooler than 2020. And so that may be due to just kind of uncorrelated weather events. It may be possibly due to a resumption of activity that produces aerosols in the atmosphere. Because in 2020, you'll recall, we estimated that the various lockdowns around the world had actually increased the temperature of the planet slightly because of the clearing out of nitrates and other aerosols due to basically transportation. So 2021 would have been a relatively cool year even without the La Nina. But obviously you can still see that it would have been a very, very warm year. And you can see the quantification of my estimate of how important ENSO is in any particular year on the side there. Russ?
All right, thanks, Gavin. So on the next slide, slide 8, what we see is something a little different. This is a little bit related to what Gavin was talking about. It's still ocean-related, but it's something called ocean heat content. And credit goes to one of my colleagues at NCEI, Tim Boyer, and a large posse of folks who just published a paper a day or two ago. Ocean heat content is basically the total amount of warmth or heat energy stored in the oceans. 2021, the warmth of the world's oceans hit a record again. It's the highest since records began 6 decades ago. Technically, the 2021 number is 227 zettajoules above the average for 1981 to 2010. That's an incomprehensibly large amount of energy in my mind. The point is the oceans are storing a heck of a lot of heat. There's been a steady upward trend since at least 1970, and as with surface temperature, each decade has been warmer than the decade that preceded it. But there's a bit less variability in the record of ocean heat content because it just keeps steadily building up. Because changes in the ocean systems occur over centuries, the oceans have not yet warmed as much as the atmosphere, even though they've absorbed more than 90% of the Earth's heat since the mid-1950s. If not for the large heat storage capacity provided by the oceans, the atmosphere would have warmed much more rapidly. So this is the way I like to think about it. Everybody's got a stove in their house, and let's assume it's a gas stove for a second. But forget the environmental implications of gas stoves, but if you have a frying pan and you put an egg in it and you turn the gas stove on, it's going to, like, heat's going to go into that egg pretty fast. If you have another pot that's got, that's filled with water and you want to boil, I don't know, spaghetti or something like that in there, you could turn the gas on, but it's going to take quite a while for that water to boil, even though the heat's going directly onto the pan. Again, that's just because water has a, can hold a lot of heat, and that's sort of what's happening to the oceans right now. It takes a lot of energy for them to warm up. And I will stop there and hand the baton back to Gavin.
Thanks. This slide relates to what's happening in the Arctic. You can see very clearly in the main graph that we're seeing continued loss of Arctic sea ice. Not a record loss last year in terms of the September mean, but you can see the trends are very clear. We've lost around 40% of the sea ice in September, which is the minimum sea ice extent, and just under 10% of the ice in the peak winter time in March, and that's being driven by what we call Arctic amplification. You can see with the inset there that the Arctic temperature changes are proceeding much, much faster than the global mean. And if you calculate the ratio of those trends, say, over the last 30 years, you end up with something north of three times as fast. That's a very dramatic change locally, but it also has impacts away from the Arctic. It has impacts because of the melting of mountain glacier and ice sheet mass that's adding to sea level. It has impacts because of the thawing of the permafrost, which is releasing carbon as carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere as a amplifying feedback on climate change, and potentially maybe impacting dynamics in the mid-latitudes. So that's more of a speculation at this point. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, and the changes there are really extremely dramatic.
All right.
Russ?
All right. So on to slide 10 now. The punchline from this slide is the analyses track one another over time. So what this plot here shows is temperature from not just the NASA analysis, that one's in blue, and not just the NOAA analysis, that one's in orange, but a few other analyses from around the world. And they go back to the late 19th century, and they continue up to present day. And they tell basically the same story. They all show this evolution of temperature being fairly steady up into the early 20th century, an increase up until about the Second World War, a slight decrease to the mid-1960s, and a steady and somewhat more rapid increase thereafter. And I'm telling this story because each of the different analyses depicted on this graph is done in a different way. They use different methodologies. They have different coverages of the Earth's surface. They make different assumptions about how to handle air temperatures and sea surface temperatures. And despite all those differences, they tell the same basic story. So this is actually a good news story. In science, it's generally beneficial to have multiple groups taking a crack at the same problem independently. And when they do and they tell a story like this, you have much greater confidence in the results. So, again, the punchline here is it doesn't really matter how you do the analysis. They all tell you that the Earth has warmed quite dramatically over the past century. And now back to Gavin. He gets the last word here this morning.
I doubt that very much. Following on Russ's point, having independent validation of the trends that we're seeing is very important. And for the more recent period, so not going back to the 19th century, but for the period 1979 onwards, we do have the reanalyses data sets to look at. So a reanalysis is the use of a modern weather forecast model to go back and make weather forecasts using as much data as they can bring in, a lot of satellite data, a lot of pressure data, and then kind of just estimate the global mean temperatures associated with that. It uses some station data, but it doesn't use the same station data that the NOAA and GISTemp analyses use. And so it is it's a different methodology that uses a model to do the interpolation as opposed to statistics on its own. And what you can see there in the first row are the trends from 1979 in both the ERA, European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting Reanalysis version 5 record, and in the GISTemp record. And you'll see that the spatial patterns are extremely coherent. The magnitudes vary a little, and there's more detail in the reanalysis because there's more smoothing in the statistical analyses. But the trends are very, very clear. They've both warmed around 0.8 degrees Celsius over the that's a 43 year period now. And we also have direct and totally independent estimates of surface temperature that come from the AIRS instrument, which is on the AQUA satellite. And this is and this does not use any of the same data that is used in either the reanalysis or the or the statistical analysis of weather stations. And there, the differences are a little bit larger, but the basic patterns are very clear and the trends are commensurate. The biggest differences in the latest version of the AIRS trends, which is their version 7, is that they see a significantly larger cooling in the Southern Ocean, right around the edge of the sea ice. And it's not clear to us or anybody whether that's real, but it is one of the areas in the world that is poorly sampled by the buoy data and the ship data. And so in areas where there is greater uncertainty about what's going on, it's kind of interesting to see what the different methodologies produce there. But the basic trends are very similar. The ups and downs are very similar, and basically these ways of looking at the temperature changes validate the confidence that we have and increase the confidence that we have when we go back before we had these multiple variations, multiple ways of looking at it. And so we'll move to the Q&A period. John.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much, Gavin and Russ. Great, great talk. Yes, it is now time for questions, everyone. Kelly, could you please remind the participants how to ask a question, and then please queue up the first question?
Absolutely. So if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name. And if you'd like to withdraw your question, you can press star 2. And it looks like we've got some questions queued up. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein from the Associated Press. Seth, your line is open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. I have one question for Russell, one for Gavin. For Russell, given the calculations you have for 2022, and given the trend, the long-term trend, and that stepwise increase you highlighted, how soon do you expect us to be at 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial, given that we're at 1.1, 1.2 on those calculations? And is this sort of accelerating? And for Gavin, I know you said that the temperatures have tripled over the last 30 years, going three times faster in the Arctic. But looking at that graphic, can you tell us how the Arctic did compared to the rest of the world in 2021? Thank you.
All right, I'll take a crack here first, Gavin. And by the way, nice to hear from you again, Seth. The first part of your question, I think, was about when do we basically hit 1.5 degrees C of warming? That's 1.5 degrees C higher than the pre-industrial period. This, for the general audience, this is the number that's of relevance in the Paris Agreement. Ideally, they want to keep warming to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius. And my understanding is that there's probably a 50-50 chance that at least 1 year during this decade will hit the 1.5 degree threshold. I think this comes from either IPCC or WMO, I can't remember which. And going forward, sometime in the 2030s or certainly by the early 2040s, the average temperature, average global temperature, will almost certainly exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius. So we're not there yet, but we're approaching that point, and that trajectory is unlikely to change as long as we keep emitting greenhouse gases, whether they be carbon dioxide, methane, or nitrous oxides and other things to drive the temperature increase.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me just come in a little bit on that as well. Current trends are around 0.2, 0.25 degrees Celsius per decade. And so if we're around 1.1 now, then the kind of trend would expect 1.5 in around, a decade and a bit. We would anticipate that 1 year would cross that threshold before that, as a function of an El Nino event, for instance. I'd just like to put out there, though, that the crossing these thresholds doesn't mean very much. What matters is that we understand that as the temperatures increase, we're going to see more impacts, and they're going to be nonlinear in the temperature. But it's not the case that, at 1.4 everything is hunky-dory, and at 1.6 all hell is broken loose. We're already seeing the impacts of the global warming that we're talking about now. We're seeing it in the impacts in local weather and in extremes. We have got a situation now where we can detect the contribution of human warming on things like the heat waves in the Pacific Northwest, like the intense precipitation that accompanied Hurricane Ida, or the floods in Germany, or the floods in China. We can see this very clearly in coastal flooding, in the impacts on the ice sheets and mountain glaciers. Those will increase, and so we've got to a point. People, we discussed a little bit earlier on that the last 7 years seem kind of anomalous, but we've reached a point where the global warming data that we're talking about here is no longer a kind of an esoteric or an academic measure of what's going on, but it's being reflected in the weather and in the events that that we're seeing. And obviously, not every single one of the significant events of 2021 is going to have a very strong attribution to the human warming that we've seen, but many of them do, and many of the heat waves, intense rainfalls, flooding events are going to be found to have a contribution from the human-induced warming. And so to answer Seth's question related to the Arctic, did not have a hugely warm year compared to 2016, for instance. The ups and downs in the Arctic are larger than they are in the global mean. It's a smaller area. There's a lot of variability. But what we're seeing is, again, another very warm year that is having noticeable impacts on the environment there.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jim Siegel. Jim, your line is open.
Oh, thank you for doing this analysis, and thank you for taking my question. Just to follow up on a little bit on Seth's question, bigger picture, have you or other people made an estimate or an assessment of the relative contribution of various aspects of that cause weather cooling or warming, for example, the number of internal combustion engine cars and trucks, the number of population, various industrial activity. What about animals emitting methane? What about the sun? Does that have an effect, and what is that? And in general, other kinds of weather techniques. So, what if anything do you know about these relative contributors to global warming or cooling?
Thanks for that question. Happy to discuss that. There was a much deeper dive into that in the last IPCC report, which came out in August. But here, let me give you the brief summary. For all the different things that could cause climate to change, and you mentioned some of them, you know, solar activity, volcanoes, deforestation, air pollution, greenhouse gases, internal variability in the ocean. Each one of those has a specific fingerprint of effects. So, for instance, if the sun becomes more active, that warms the whole of the atmosphere from the mesosphere to the surface. If during variations in the ocean, you see a transfer of heat from the ocean to the atmosphere. After a volcano, you see warming in the stratosphere, cooling at the surface. For greenhouse gases, you see cooling in the stratosphere and the mesosphere and warming at the surface. And when you put together the history of the sun and the volcanoes and wobbles in the Earth's orbit and greenhouse gases and deforestation and air pollution and all the rest of it, what you find is that if you don't include the greenhouse gas effects, you can't explain what's happening to any degree at all. But when you put together the greenhouse gases and all of the natural things that are going on, you get a very good match to what's actually happened. And when you ask those kinds of analyses, or where are the trends coming from, the answer is the increases in greenhouse gases almost exclusively. So the changes in the sun over the last 100 or so years are not large enough to make a significant trend. We haven't seen a trend because of volcanoes. We haven't seen a significant impact because of the Milankovitch cycles or anything like that, which work on much longer timescales. And we see cooling from atmospheric pollutants such as nitrate and sulfate aerosols. But when you put all these things together, and there was a very nice figure in the summary for policymakers from the August IPCC report, it showed very clearly that the contributions to the trend that we see, it's about 40% of it is carbon dioxide, another third is methane, and then, you know, ozone changes, black carbon changes kind of add up to the other parts that were causing the warming. Yes, you know, carbon dioxide is mostly driven by the burning of fossil fuels in internal combustion engines, in industrial processes, and for power generation. Also, cement and deforestation contribute to that. Methane increases are due to landfills, oil and gas operations, agricultural activities. So those are contributing as well to that change in greenhouse gases that is the by far the clearest cause of the trends that we're seeing.
I can add just a bit to what Gavin said, who pretty much hit the nail on the head there, but IPCC literally said, you know, natural factors like volcanoes and solar activity, the effect of those over the last couple hundred years was basically negligible. But in contrast, you can see that carbon dioxide concentrations now are as high as they've been in, I think, a couple of million years. So, you know, it all sorts itself out pretty well.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Issam Ahmed. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. This was for Gavin. He raised a point in the call which I wasn't aware about and I didn't fully understand, which was that the impact of lockdowns in 2020 might have actually increased the temperature of the planet, and he said because of the clearing of nitrates and other aerosols. Could you just explain that a little further, please?
Sure. So the impacts of lockdowns were seen very, very clearly in the concentration of pollutants like nitrous oxides, nitrates, sulfates, and ozone. And so where those lockdowns happened first, you saw it in China, then you saw it in Northern Europe, and then you saw it in the U.S., we saw a very rapid cleaning of the atmosphere. And the particles that are there are there reflective for the most part. And that means that when you put more of them into the atmosphere, it reflects the sun away from the surface, and so it cools the surface. So if you take them away and you make the air cleaner, then that's a slight warming impact on the climate. Now, there were decreases as well in carbon dioxide. In 2020, carbon dioxide emissions fell by about 6% globally. But we're putting so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that doesn't change very much what the annual increment in carbon dioxide was. And so the changes in carbon dioxide lag slightly the changes in aerosols, which have a faster effect. And so when they go away, the dominant thing is that there's cooling from the lack of aerosols in the air compared to in contrast to what's happening with carbon dioxide. And so as the lockdowns kind of lifted and activity resumed, particularly transportation, then we would expect and we have seen that the aerosols would pick back up again, as have carbon dioxide emissions.
Thanks. That's really well explained.
Our next question comes from Chelsea Goad. Chelsea, your line is open.
Thank you so much. Chelsea Goad with space.com. So as you've both mentioned, the extreme events and impacts we saw in 2021 are, just the tip of the iceberg, excuse the pun. But, what can we expect in the near term, in 2022, 2023, if climate change trends continue as expected? And I'm also curious, in both of your opinions, are there climate mitigation tactics that could still make a significant difference, and what are they? I think people often hear this news, about the annual global temperatures, and, their immediate thought is, wow, it's still so bad, it's getting worse, it's too late to even fix it. Is that true?
So, Gavin, I'll take the first half of that, and you can take the second. I think Gavin and I would both hesitate to make predictions about like the next year or two in terms of what the extreme events might look like. It's one of these things that on the average, by and large, more or less, all other things being equal, if you add more heat to the system, heat tends to fuel a lot of extremes. Sea surface temperatures that are above normal are going to like certainly encourage the development of tropical cyclones. Hot, dry air certainly like provides fuel for fires. But I don't think we would make any predictions about what we're going to see in, let's say, the next couple of years. I think we probably feel more comfortable saying as we go forward, each successive year, we're going to expect to see more of these in the future than we have in the past. And I don't think either one of us likes telling that story, but that's more likely what's going to happen. As for the mitigation question, that's a great one for Gavin.
Thanks, Russ. I'll just confirm. I mean, we can't predict where in the world extreme events will occur this far out. I mean, that's a function of very short-term weather dynamics, which are only predictable perhaps 10 days to 2 weeks ahead. But we can predict, I think, with some confidence that we will see more and more extreme heat waves and more intense rainfall and more coastal flooding. I think exactly where those will happen and what the impacts will be are unclear, but the statistical In a statistical sense, I think we can make those predictions. And so, you know, it may not be the Pacific Northwest next year, but it will be somewhere. And we'll obviously have to be prepared for those kinds of things. So with respect to the mitigation question, what we have learned is that temperatures will keep on rising as long as we keep increasing the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so if we get to net zero for carbon dioxide and we reduce the other greenhouse gases as well, then we can stabilize the temperatures and we'll just, you know, it's not going to cool, but it wouldn't keep getting worse. And so mitigation efforts that are directed towards reducing greenhouse gases or increasing the absorption of greenhouse gases are things that can make a difference. There are many, many different ways to do that. And quite frankly, what we see because of the cumulative nature of carbon dioxide as a climate forcing, every little bit that you don't release reduces the temperature in the future, and so every little bit counts. And so there's not a point at which it's not worth continuing to try, because any efforts make the future problems less. Right. So, when we go through 1.5 degrees Celsius, it will still be worth reducing emissions to avoid the consequences of 2 or 2.5 degrees. And that's always going to be the case. That there's never going to be a point at which it's not worth doing something on emissions to reduce the problems going forward into the future.
Our next question comes from Eric Rossin. Eric, your line is open.
Hi, thanks everyone. Sort of a technical best practices question is when, we're reporting on ostensibly, one phenomenon that's measured by multiple groups, all with valid results, and, some of them have there's the last 7 hottest years are, last 7 years are the hottest on record. Somebody else says the last 8 years are the hottest on record. Does it matter? Is there a right answer? How are we to deal with that ambiguity in rankings like that and also in the temperature values themselves?
That's an excellent question. I mean, we do a pretty extensive uncertainty quantification on these numbers. And so, if you want to get back to me offline, I can provide that for you. But that means that, there is a right answer, but we only have imperfect information. And so there's always going to be a little bit of ambiguity and a margin of error on these questions. As to whether it matters, it does not matter anymore. I think, when the signal was smaller, then it made a difference a little bit. But I think that all of the groups have now, I think, improved what we're doing. We have more digitized data that is helping reduce the uncertainty. We've dealt with non-climatic impacts on the ocean analysis and homogenization issues with weather stations far better than we were doing 10 years ago. And so the differences are smaller than they were. And because the signal is larger, they're even less important. So I don't really get hung up on these things anymore. The big story is the long-term trend, not the individual ranking, despite our presence here in this press conference.
Well, I think it's also important to remember, too, that this is just one indicator of a world that's warming. We mentioned ocean heat content. We talked about Arctic sea ice. There are a great many other things that point in the same direction, whether it be glacier mass loss or ice sheet mass loss from Greenland and Antarctica. you can even get into the biosphere. There are species, lots of species tend to be moving northward toward colder locations or uphill toward cooler locations or in the ocean toward greater depths where it's cooler. So there's a lot of collective information that paints this coherent picture of a warming world, which is the other reason I don't get too hung up on whether, like, it was the last 7 or 8 years were the warmest on record. It's pretty clear that it's getting warmer.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Peter Garrett. Peter, your line is open.
Hello. I heard the other day from a scientist by the name of Peter Fikowski, lives in California, and he was talking about climate restoration, various ways that you could use, that humanity can use natural processes to take carbon dioxide out of the air. Have you heard about any of that, and does that begin to make sense?
I'm happy to take that question. Yes, I mean, so the thermodynamics or the chemistry of removal of carbon dioxide from the ambient air is actually quite well established. The problems that exist, though, is that it costs quite a lot of money per ton of carbon dioxide removed. Numbers range in the, you know, $600 to $1,000 per ton of carbon dioxide removed. And that means that that pretty much anything that you do to reduce emissions in the first place is going to be cheaper than taking it out of the air afterwards. But there are a lot of efforts to investigate that, and then to investigate what to do with that carbon dioxide once you've removed it, because you need to store it somewhere where it isn't going to go back into the atmosphere for many thousands of years. That's another challenge. You know, people, I think, would like it to be cheaper and would like it to work. But speaking personally, you know, this is very kind of cutting edge technology. At NASA, we had a CO2 conversion challenge last year, which was, you know, a prize to support businesses that were efficiently removing carbon to make complex chemicals, and so the winners of that prize were also working in this space as well. We're trying to encourage that as an agency, but as a near-term climate solution, it's still quite a long way away.
Okay, that was the last question in our queue. So, John, I will hand it back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, everyone. I'd like to remind folks that there will be an audio file of this call posted and available for download from the online NOAA Media Advisory later this afternoon. Also, if you have any additional questions or further informational needs, you can contact me, John Bateman, at the email address available on the Media Advisory. Thank you, everyone.
That concludes today's call. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.